This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, a show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. This is a show I've been looking forward to. We have two guests coming on to join us today. First, we're going to be talking with Dr. Matthew Prezioso. Dr. Prezioso is a dentist in Southington, Connecticut, and I wanted to get someone on to talk a little bit about the use of fluoride in the water supply, because there are communities in the United States that are now eliminating fluoride from that water supply. And it's clearly my understanding that the data clearly show that the addition of fluoride, which is a natural element, to the water supply has really aided in dental care, especially in children in underserved populations, in underserved areas. So, again, we're going to chat with Dr. Prezioso to really get down to the bottom of that issue with fluoride. Then, in the second half of our program, we're going to have Dr. Mary Gina Rochford rejoin us. It's always a pleasure to have her on from the Rochford Eye Center. And, you know, a few questions came up in my mind as we were preparing for the eclipse and the use of special glasses if you were going to look at the eclipse. So it got me to think more and more about the effect of bright light on the eye, and to see where those changes occur, and should we be a little bit more concerned about that as climate has changed. So she's going to be on in the second half of our program. I already have a question for her from one of our listeners, and I'm going to pose that to her. But if you have questions that you'd like to pose to either of my guests, you can reach me live at info@alessimd.com. And I'm happy to answer that or propose that to our guests. One of the things people know about me is I love talking to other folks, just no matter where I meet them. I'm just chatting with them. I'm always curious about what other people do for a living and try to get their perspective. Well, last week at the end of our program, I didn't get to ask this question from Margaret, which was that embalmers are reporting rubbery amyloid clots blocking their procedures. Is this true? Now, that is apropos to our guest last week, Dr. Evan Nadler, who talked to us about pulmonary emboli and clots people get in their legs. So this was an interesting question that I never really thought about, is do any kind of clots, whether they be amyloid clots or arterial clots that become calcified, an issue for people who perform embalming? So sure enough, this week I meet a fellow who's an embalmer. And he's retired and spent his time embalming. He did a variety of things, not just funeral home, but preparing bodies for dissection for medical schools at the University of Connecticut. But anyhow, so I asked him the question, is has that been an issue? And he said that we do find obstructions of a variety of types when trying to do the embalming itself, but we have other chemicals that we're able to inject to liquefy those clots and be able to continue with the procedure. So it was interesting. So I think it's a real issue, but embalmers are able to get around that. This day in medicine is May 18th, 1861. Dr. Friedrich August von Amon died. Dr. von Amon was an ophthalmologist in Germany. Apropos to our guest today, Dr. Rochford, he introduced blepharoplasty. And blepharoplasty, for those unfamiliar with it, is a cosmetic procedure where you change the appearance of the eyelids. So people a lot of times think of it as a way of getting rid of wrinkles and things like that, but there are other people who need their eyelids altered, whether a result of an accident or scarring or things such as that. So he introduced blepharoplasty. He also introduced a procedure known as dacryocystotomy, which is drainage of the lacrimal sac to alter and drain tears. So that was 1861 when he passed away. I always like to pick up topics that have been in the news, and I thought this one was particularly interesting, and that is the revelation that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Had a problem with his cognitive abilities as a result of a worm, a parasite in his brain, as well as mercury poisoning. Now, I'm not going to get into the politics of it. This is a medical program, but I thought it raised interesting questions about the finding of a cyst in his brain that contained a parasite. This isn't uncommon, and it's what we call neurocysticercosis, and it's uncommon in the United States, but certainly not uncommon in Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, India, and Asia. And he brought up the point that he traveled extensively and certainly may have taken on a worm, the Taenia solium, the pork tapeworm, that is part of this condition. I've seen many patients in Haiti with neurocysticercosis. They usually present with seizures and epilepsy. So one of the things we do right away when someone presents with new epilepsy is we get a scan of the brain, and often you will see these calcified cysts in the brain. It doesn't come from just eating the raw pork. I think there's a misunderstanding. When you eat raw pork, you get a tapeworm that produces an intestinal problem. So that intestinal problem, it lives in the intestine and in the wall of the intestine. The real problem comes on when you pass that tapeworm or what are the eggs of that tapeworm, when they pass through your intestine and are emitted in the feces. So really, in order to get this tapeworm in the brain, you have to imbibe and take in, in some way, swallow these eggs of the tapeworm itself so that we'll get into the bloodstream and eventually the brain. So it speaks to the issue of really good hand hygiene. And you might think that's easy to do, but in many of these countries, when you're out on a mission, you don't have warm water or hot water. So you rely a lot on Purell and other ways of sanitizing your hands before you eat. And especially if you're around dirt where people may have defecated. So the other thing is that of the symptoms you see with neurocysticercosis, I already mentioned seizures being the biggest one, and the seizures come when there's a reaction against the worm or the cyst, but memory loss is not one of the problems that we would see with this. So him claiming that he had memory loss as a result of this was more likely about his second revelation, and the second revelation was mercury poisoning. Again, rare in the United States, but there are different forms of mercury poisoning. There's elemental mercury, inorganic mercury, and organic mercury. The elemental mercury is the liquid you see in a thermometer, for example, or electrical switches. So there's elemental mercury, the same one you'd see in dental fillings. Organic mercury is what you would see in fish that you find from eating a lot of fish, where you can get that. You also see it in my readings. You see it in mercurochrome. I think many of our listeners are old enough to remember, as I do, whenever you got a cut on your finger or on your body, your parents said, well, we'll just put mercurochrome on it, that red liquid that they put on as an antiseptic. But my point here is that Mercury poisoning certainly can produce memory loss. My experience with mercury poisoning is actually with regard to elemental mercury. I was part of a study back in 1985 and 1986 at the Y-12 facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where we looked at, I was part of the group from the University of Michigan, and we went back to look at a large group of people who worked at the Y-12 plant producing the atomic weapon, the bomb. And it was felt that mercury would be the trigger for that bomb, for the atomic weapon at the time. And they accumulated 90% of the elemental mercury in the world in these large swimming pools that people would walk through in order to keep it clean. So we looked at a lot of people who were exposed to mercury. And actually, it was not a dramatic number who had had dementia. You could understand that we were looking at these people some 40 years later, and many were quite elderly. But it's interesting because you don't usually see poisoning from elemental mercury. With that, we're getting on. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my first guest, Dr. Matthew Prezioso of Southington Family Dentistry. We're going to be talking about fluoride in our water supply. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my guest, Dr. Matthew Prezioso. Dr. Prezioso is a doctor of medical dentistry. He practices at Southington Family Dentistry, and he's agreed to come on to chat with us a little bit about fluoride in the water. Hey, Matt, thanks for coming on.
No problem. Thank you for having me on.
Let's talk. So fluoride in the water, good thing, bad thing? What's the history behind it? Why do we put it in there? Give us the whole scope of things here.
Yeah, so fluoride obviously as a supplement, obviously it's in toothpaste and everything. The biggest reason for supplementing water supply with fluoride is it does have an effect on preventing cavities, strengthening and remineralizing the tooth structure to help prevent against the erosion and acid that is produced by the bacteria in our mouth whenever we have anything with sugar in it, carbohydrates. So it does have plenty of benefits. Obviously, for younger kids, it is a good supplementation. That's about it.
Well, when did we start putting fluoride in water? I mean, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely been a long time. Obviously, there are areas that do not have fluoride in it, there's testing kits that are out there where you can test actually how much fluoride is in your water to be able to determine if you need supplemental dosages, especially in young children, to make sure that they're getting the proper amount, preventing against any decay.
Matt, is there any scientific argument against putting fluoride in the water?
Not necessarily. I mean, there is a limit in terms of there is such thing as too much fluoride where teeth can start to have white spot lesions, fluorosis when there is too much, but there's not really any detriment of having too much.
Well, how does it compare to, you mentioned the use of fluoride in toothpaste. I remember when I was in Haiti, we'd have volunteers coming and doing fluoride treatments. They almost paint fluoride onto the teeth. How does that work?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's very similar in terms of just the exposure, making sure that the teeth are getting that proper amount of exposure to fluoride. I mean, like in our office, whenever kids come in for six-month visits, we typically do put a fluoride varnish on them because, I mean, not necessarily that, like I said, some people's water supply don't have fluoride in it and they don't even realize it. So having that extra dosing to make sure that the teeth are protected, especially in younger kids, is important and something that we do in our office for routine visits for kids.
Do you find that, so overall, you know, I remember it, and to make it personally, people my age, I think we always had a lot more cavities. Is it common to even see cavities in children these days?
Yeah, I mean, we see plenty of kids come in with cavities from exposure. Definitely the biggest thing in kids is the amount of sugar intake, because the more time you're exposing their teeth to that sugar, especially in milk, juices, especially if they're drinking it through a bottle all day, all that time that those teeth are being exposed to that sugar intake gives more chance for bacteria in our mouth to feed on that and then produce that acid that causes tooth decay.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit here because when I was young, we had fillings with mercury, right? And we just talked a little bit about mercury poisoning. Do you still use regular silver fillings, or when did that go away?
I mean, it's very rare that we do use the old silver amalgam fillings, mostly for aesthetic purposes. I mean, most people nowadays, they don't want a bunch of silver in their mouth, so we do use mostly those white composite fillings. But there are certain situations where we do still use those silver fillings because as opposed to the white composite fillings, you need kind of an isolated field. No saliva, blood can mix with it, and that affects the bonding strength of the filling. So if you have a patient that have bunch of bleeding, you can't control the saliva flow, then there are certain situations where we do still use those silver fillings.
You know, Matt, I remember some patients, if they had problems with cognition, they would go to a dentist and have all their fillings taken out. Do you ever have people coming in and say, I want all my silver fillings taken out? I mean, do people request that? Or?
Yeah, we do from time to time, especially because people are afraid of the amount of mercury that's in those. But I mean, studies have shown that the amount of mercury that is in those silver fillings is negligible and not significant. So every now and then we do have patients that come in requesting that. Typically, if it's really what they want, we'll do it. But in our practice, unless there's kind of cause where the fillings are breaking down, you're starting to see decay around the margins of it, then we typically kind of leave things, watch, and as it's needed, replace those.
Matt, thank you. Thanks for taking time today. That's Dr. Matthew Prezioso. If you wish
to get
in touch with Dr. Prezioso, you could reach him at 860-628-4761 at Southington Family Dentistry. Matt, thanks again for your time today.
No problem. Thank you for having me on.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with our next guest, Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And just wanted to let you know that if you have questions for me during the show or during the week, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. My next guest is Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. Dr. Ratchford is the principal at the Ratchford Eye Center. She is a medical doctor, ophthalmologist, and eye surgeon, and has been with us many times before. It's always a pleasure, especially when we have questions that come up regarding the eye and vision. Mary Gina, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay. So,
good.
Wanted to talk a little bit about the effects of bright light. So everybody was getting excited. We were going to have a solar eclipse and getting special glasses together and finding different ways. And we always alert people to the danger of looking directly at a bright light like the eclipse. So it raised the question of what is the damage that's done, and where is the damage when looking at bright light from that standpoint?
Okay, yeah. So if we kind of review what the anatomy of the eye is, you know, there are structures in the front of the eye that help focus the light, and that would be a pair of glasses, your lens, whether it's natural or artificial. But all those mechanisms do an effective job of focusing light onto the retina. Now, the retina is the wallpaper of the eye. It's it's a neurosensitive part of your body, but there's a more specific part of the retina called the macula, and that's where the super sensitive receptors are for fine detail, and that's where the majority of the light gets focused. Now, because those receptors are responsive to light, there is a natural spectrum of light that's safe for the eye. When we get into the intensity of an ultraviolet light, that light is so intense that prolonged exposure of those receptors to that type of light will cause damage to certain layers of the retina, specifically something called the retinal pigment epithelium, but that damages the cells that will then no longer be able to accept light. So what people might experience with something called solar retinopathy, which is what that condition can lead to. And by the way, we can see this with laser pointers and with welding. So those are two other maybe more common scenarios where someone may, with prolonged exposure to that light, experience damage. We don't have eclipses, you know, every day, but there definitely are laser pointers that people are familiar with. But with that damage, you can get a blind spot in the center. You can experience something called metamorphopsia, which is a wavy line instead of your lines that should be straight appear wavy. There may be missing parts to it because those receptors, again, don't work properly. So we really want to try to avoid that, because if you do develop it, there isn't a lot of effective treatment to repair those type of cells.
So it's interesting, especially the laser pointer idea. So
yeah.
So if someone is shining a laser pointer in your eye, obviously that's going to do some damage.
Of course, right. And we do see that, you know, with that intense direct light on those very sensitive cells, if you're waving the laser pointer, you're not likely to get damaged. But if it's prolonged and you look at it, you know, for a gag or for whatever, then there's a likely chance that you're going to develop permanent damage.
How do these specialized glasses work then? So if people are wanted to look at the eclipse, right, they say, well, you know, get these $8 glasses or whatever. How does that work? How does that protect the eye?
Yeah, so, you know, regular sunglasses will protect you from ultraviolet A and B, but there is a more intense light that you need to protect your eyes with something called solar filters. And those solar filters have a specific, filter, and it's the ISO 12312-2. So it's a very special filter that will allow, you know, not that extreme amount of light to get into the eye. And so those are the only, you know, filters that are likely to protect your eyes when looking at something like the sun.
But how about, so are those solar filters also built into the regular eyeglasses we buy, sunglasses?
No. It's an extra filter that really only comes with these eclipse glasses. So if you had regular sunglasses and you were looking at the eclipse, you would not get proper protection. You need this extra special filter for the intensity of the sun.
Okay, let's kind of shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about everyday exposure to the sun. With changes in climate, are we getting more exposure? Do we need to be more careful every day when we're out in the sun?
I would say absolutely yes. You know, even from a young age, you know, if you think about the amount of exposure to the sunlight that you get from birth to, you know, when you're in your 80s, there's a lot of that that can accumulate and cause damage. So we know about the risk of skin cancer. There certainly are skin cancers around the eyes and the eyelids, things like basal cell and squamous cell, even melanomas. In fact, there is a type of eye cancer called a choroidal melanoma, which can be deadly. And so anybody who's at risk, whether family history or light skinned, is really advised to wear sunglasses, you know, really anytime they're outside. So even on a cloudy day, you still have UV exposure that could lead to damage. So there, you know, even on a cloudy day, we do recommend you wearing sunglasses. So aside from the risk of skin cancer and eye cancer, we do worry about premature aging of the skin. We do worry about premature development of cataracts, and there is an association with you know, macular degeneration in people who do have excessive ultralight exposure. So for my patients who I'm watching for the early stages of macular degeneration, I always recommend, you know, no smoking, wear your sunglasses, and eat your vegetables. So it's really a good habit to get into from a young age to protect your eyes as you get older.
When we get into sunglasses, we're talking about a big market here because there are so many different types. Everybody touts one thing to be better than the other, polarized, non-polarized. And obviously we get into the design or labels of these. But can you tell us something about what makes a good pair of sunglasses?
Right. So, you know, they're not just a fashion statement, although, you know, people definitely, you know, do like the style. So number one is you do want to get 100% UVA and UVB protection, and that's protection up to 400 nanometers. So there's a spectrum of light. So you really want to make sure that you get 100%. If you have darker sunglasses, that doesn't always mean that you get 100% UV protection. So there really should be a label on that that identifies that 100% A and B. Now, polarized lenses, which is another factor, they reduce the glare, but they don't necessarily block the UV rays. And the way that polarized lenses work is they do filter the light before it gets to your eye. So it almost reduces some scatter, and it gives you a much clearer image. If you are buying sort of glasses over the counter, you know, you just want to make sure that if you, you know, kind of tilt your head up and down, that you have a clear image all the way around. It just means that the lens is of better quality. You know, we look at the size of the sunglasses. You know, we really prefer ones that do a wraparound side of across the side of your face so that you can sort of eliminate some of the light that can get in from the side. And again, to the brow and down to the orbital rim. So that, again, you protect all those ocular structures of the skin so that you are protected, again, not only from the harmful rays in your eye, but around the skin. I often get questions about color. Does gray or, you know, any other color matter?
That was my next question. And, so I'm glad that's a popular question.
Right. Yeah. So they don't block out more sun. You know, there are some mirror images that can make it look nice, but they don't necessarily reflect or diminish the amount of sunlight that gets into the eyes. So again, that's more of a fashion statement. I do just sort of rule of thumb for somebody who's like a hiker or likes to be outside. I like the brown tint. If you're a beach water fisherman, then, you know, the greener tints can be better, but that's just, again, a recommendation. Some people who are more sensitive to light might really like the amount, you know, more filtered. Some that are, you know, really kind of don't enjoy the light may not need such a darker color. The other thing that you can get built into your ordinary, regular, everyday glasses is a transition lens. And those are nice because they do filter 100% A and B, but they adjust the tint to the ambient light. So if you're in a bright light outside, it gets dark. If you walk into the grocery store, it'll lighten up so that you can still manage without having to fumble between two different pairs of glasses. And so a lot of folks do like those as well.
With the transition lenses, just out of curiosity, one of the big complaints was the fact that it took too long to transition. So you would, you know, go from outside it being dark and then walking inside, and I'd see people taking their glasses off because it would take a long time for it to clear up. Has that gotten better?
It definitely has gotten better. Yeah, with the new photoreceptors in the glasses, that transition time really has gotten quite quick. I mean, it's not instantaneous, so... Yeah. You know, when I come in from my car with my transition lenses, you know, I look in the mirror, it's still a little bit dark, but it doesn't impact my vision. I can still, you know, walk in and start preparing a meal without really having to take my glasses off because it's too dark. So I do like those. You know, again, if you have any disease like early stages of a cataract or macular degeneration, having that protection on more full time without having to necessarily switch from one pair of glasses to another, you know, can not only be convenient, but can keep you safe.
I have a question for you from Margaret, and it's an interesting question. The issue has been people who experience temporary blindness, particularly at night, when you're driving and you have these bright headlights, is there something going on with that in terms of insurance and protecting people? So I think a lot has to do, some of these, the headlights have changed. Well, clearly, we've gone to more halogen lights and things such as that. So that temporary blinding, if you get those right in your eyes, especially if there's a truck coming in the other direction, I think that's what Margaret's saying is, you know, should there be some glasses or a windshield coating or something of that nature to protect drivers from that glare at night?
Yeah, that's a good question. I get that question a lot in my practice and, from people of all ages. So, what I recommend is try to avoid that supersaturation of the receptors where you're, quote, temporarily, blind. So I would, I tell my patients to sort of make sure you pay attention to the lines on the side of the road, those white or yellow lines. Don't look directly in the opposite lane. Look at the car ahead of you. Now, having said that, there are some anti-glare coating. They don't reduce the intensity of that oncoming light, but they can filter the light so things are a little bit clearer. There are some filters in the windshields, but they don't really reduce the intensity of the light coming from those oncoming headlights. So I think the best thing you can do is really just to avoid looking directly at it. Avert your eyes so that you can certainly pay attention to the car in front of you, but stay in the same lane by looking at those lines on either side so that you stay in the right lane. And if it's really where you feel unsafe, then you just may have to try to do your activities in the day when you're not feeling unsafe because of the intense glare that your eyes don't adapt to.
Sure. As a follow-up question to that, I guess, sure. Yeah. One of my questions is, I always thought that when you start seeing that distortion of glare, it's an indication that you may have a problem with cataracts. Is that true?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So when we think about, again, that visual system where a light comes from a source and by the time it gets to your retina, it gets scattered. And that's what glare is. And so we look at, the glasses, make sure that they're the appropriate power. We do think about a dry eye. So if your tear film is a little bit unstable or not healthy, especially at the end of the day, that can also scatter the light, contributing to glare. But most often, if you're over the age of 50, then those cataracts are really, that's one of the earliest symptoms of a cataract is glare at night. And your pupil dilates a little bit, the light doesn't get focused properly, there's a little scatter that winds up on the retina, and things aren't as clear as they should be. So we do try to mitigate those symptoms by, again, hydrating, making sure you got the proper prescription, anti-glare, and then as best you can try to, drive when you're most comfortable during the day. Now that it's going to be lighter for longer, it may not be an issue, but definitely in winter when it's dark at 4 o'clock, that's when people's symptoms become a little bit more bothersome.
For people who ski or are active in winter sports, we always hear the term snow blindness from the glare coming off of the snow. Are routine sunglasses effective for that? I know they sell mountaineering glasses and different types of glasses for that type of brightness. Are those effective?
Yeah, so we know that there's more reflection, with the sun, against water, ice, and snow. And so the ski goggles that most folks wear, again, have that more wraparound. They do have a little bit better filter, for the intensity of the reflection of the snow. The industry really has responded by the ski goggles will give you more protection than the regular sunglasses will, just because of the different filters that are in there. I do, see a lot of folks with their helmets on and skiing with regular sunglasses, but I do think for safety and, just for the protection of the eye from the temperature and from the snow, that those ski goggles are really designed for that purpose.
Okay. One of the things we see a lot in cars is everybody seems to get these darkly tinted windows. I always wonder, it's got to be dangerous for a policeman trying to approach a vehicle or something of that. Do people get that more for privacy or is that because of eye conditions?
Yeah. So, there is a law as to how dark you can get your windshields tinted, without a doctor's note for sensitivity to light. So I think in my 22 years of practice, I only had one where it was somebody had something called uveitis, where they were very sensitive to light and needed the dark conditions. But other than that, I don't know that it offers much protection in terms of safety, unless you really have some very specific eye conditions, which are rare.
I'm going to switch gears. You recently went on a mission trip to Guatemala. Can you talk to us a little bit about what a trip like that involves?
Sure. Yeah, no, thanks for asking about that. So I work with a nonprofit group called Vision Health International, or VHI. And VHI's mission is to provide, you know, high quality eye care to underserved, you know, populations. And, you know, we do actually do a mission trip in Hartford. We do that every year. We do several around the United States. But this particular mission was overseas in Guatemala. We went to a municipality called Zacapa, which is on the map about 100 miles away from Guatemala City. And we work with a mayor, and there's different municipalities. And in Guatemala, the mayor is really an important person there. So we had to get permission from the mayor, and we always try to partner with a local group. And, you know, we look at sort of global health in general. I think there's a shift away from like these parachute types of missions where we come in, we bring everything, we do everything, and then we leave. So we work a little bit differently. So we like to partner with somebody local that we can provide sort of continual care after we go. So we partnered with the local Lions Club in, I'm going to say this wrong, but it's Tetzcalatlan. It's one of the municipalities there. So we worked with our Lions Club. So the Lions Club got us a basically like a community center. It was like a couple of big buildings. There was a kitchen area where they use to distribute food to the poor. But we basically took over that entire area. So one of the buildings, we brought our equipment. We brought a slit lamp. We brought a way that we can measure glasses, something called a four-opter. We brought our lights, our drops, everything to be able to do an exam from start to finish. We also brought all of our operating equipment. So in another building, we had to clean out the bugs, you know, and make sure that we could close the windows. And we put two exam tables, like you would go into the doctor's office. But we brought our operating microscopes. We brought our equipment. And, you know, we did cataract surgery. So we went with a team. You know, we were from the U.S. There was one of the surgeons from the U.K. We had another one of our scrub techs from Canada. So with a team of about 13 people, we came in and screened over. So we ended up doing, after all was said and done, 85 cataract operations. We did a total of 711 complete eye exams. We gave out, you know, over 800 pairs of glasses, whether they're sunglasses. You know, speaking of sunglasses, you know, most of the folks there are agricultural workers. So they develop their cataracts at a young age. They have these growths on their eyes called pterygium, which are growth off the conjunctiva just from chronic sun exposure. And, you know, these are folks that their life expectancy is maybe into the mid-60s. So when you're 40 or middle-aged, and if you can't see, it's a problem. So we ended up giving reading glasses, sunglasses. So all in all, it was just such a rewarding and successful mission. And, you know, for example, there was a woman that I did surgery on who her job is she prepares food and she sells it like as a street vendor. But she was worried about crossing the street because she couldn't see the buses that might hit her. So she took the patch off and she was just so grateful so that she could continue to do her work. You know, these are the types of stories that you hear over and over again, particularly the agriculture workers. They just want to get in back in and be able to, you know, plow their fields or go to church or, you know, see their grandkids or their children for that matter. There was one woman, she was in her 40s and she went blind from cataracts when her child was 3 and now her child was like 13 and she could see her child for the first time. So, you know, those are just, you know, why you're in the healthcare to begin with, but it's just a very rewarding experience.
It's amazing to see how many things that we take for granted, like a cataract surgery, you know, impacting like this woman for the past 10 years.
Right.
Do you go back to Guatemala then the next trip? Do they decide on another country or another locale?
Yeah. So we will be going to Guatemala again in the fall. We have two new sites in development. One of them is in Grenada, and I'm working with a team through Hartford Hospital. One of our nurse anesthetists is from Grenada, so we're trying to partner with their St. John's University. We have a pilot program in Tanzania, and we are finishing up in Honduras. So again, in Honduras, we've been there enough that we can start to hand over healthcare to local people, so we're not going to be going there as much. So those are kind of the sites that we have on our radar right now.
Wow. Well, it's great to hear, and so great to let everybody know about what's going on. And, you know, if you'll share with me the contact information for Vision Health International, if you don't have it now, I'm happy to share it in the future with if people want to donate to something so worthwhile.
That would be great. And like I said, it is both domestic and international. So we do we have one coming up in Denver. We did a Native American reservation in Montana. But it's still, you know, if the need is there, we're ready to go with the proper resources. So, yeah, I would definitely any donation would really be helpful. So thank you for that. And I will send it to you, Dr. Lessie, and you can send it out to your people.
Sounds good. Thank you. Thanks for your time today. And thanks for all your support for our program.
I love it.
Other
great
folks like you really make this possible. So thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's just great to be here.
Again, thank you again. And many thanks to our studio producer. We're coming up against a stop here. Kevin Kors has been on the board for us today and always takes care of making sure this show goes smoothly. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast. That'll be posted on Tuesday. And you get your podcasts either from Apple or Odyssey or wherever you get your podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.